This is Renegade Broadcasting. Guys, happy Friday, March 18th, 2016. Well, what do you know? They're talking about a pretty major snowstorm hitting us on Sunday. Jesus, unbelievable. Un-freaking-believable. Here it is. We've been having 60, 70. I think it even got up into the 80s the other day, degree weather. People are out, you know, biking, hiking. I saw some people riding horses the other day. I was out doing some hiking. Just, you know, beautiful weather. God damn it. We could get, you know, they're saying anywhere from 10 inches to a foot and a half in some area. I'm freaking believable, man. You know, of course, anything like that, it's not going to last. It'll be gone within a day or two. But it doesn't matter. Who the hell wants to look at that crap? I'm so sick of it. This will be the most snow we've had all winter in any one storm. Now that spring is pretty much, you know, what, 3 days? As of Monday, you know, what? Yeah, a day before spring. Unless it's actually the 20th. I don't know. Sometimes it floats, you know. Sometimes it's on the 20th. I'm not sure which day officially spring starts, but whatever. If it's Sunday, that's really going to be a kick in the ass. The first day of spring, we get dumped with a snowstorm. Anyway, we got cut off yesterday, right in the midst of, I hate when that happens. Seems to happen a lot lately. I'm about to make a very important point. In fact, yesterday I was about to make the most important point of the whole discussion. We've been on this now for what, three or four shows now. The most important part of the discussion, and damn it, the show had come to an end, got cut off in midstream, mid-thought. Anyway, I was reading, you know, some Bertrand Russell quotes on eugenics in the context of evolution. One of the rotten fruits that has been born from evolution, the reason why they embrace it so much, guys, is for philosophical reasons. One of the things that evolutionary thought has spawned is eugenics. And, you know, somebody might say, an evolutionist might say, well, you're just condemning it for philosophical reasons, but look at it from the scientific perspective, you know. Well, the scientific perspective is itself philosophical. They're making monkeys out of us, as I said, guys. They want to reduce us to the lowest common denominator, have us develop a useless notion of ourselves. A lot of evolutionists have stated, you know, that there's no meaning, there's no purpose to life. Well, on the one hand, you could argue that by saying that, you know, what's the difference between us and animals? And, you know, you can run off with that and life can get pretty meaningless and hopeless. And that's their intention, isn't it? if you draw that conclusion. But I would argue that life is full of meaning and purpose when we give it meaning and purpose. So in that sense, it's not meaningless and purposeless. So you can see how evolution, guys, destroys the meaning of life, the purpose of life. It does relegate you to a beast of the field. Don't get me wrong, because I've said many times that I think beasts of the field, have more scruples and decency than human beings often do. But that's only because we've been degraded through tribal control in our media, our government, and everything else. But we're supposed to be. Some of us are higher than the beasts of the field. And no, I didn't come from a monkey, guys. We are at least supposed to be the highest life form in this world, capable of deep intellectual thought. As far as we know, animals don't do that. Although there are some that come pretty damn close. Animals certainly do have compassion. Animals have anger. Animals can be very nasty like people sometimes. They have the potential to be, quote, evil too. Selfish, only thinking of themselves. Fortunately, it seems to be fairly rare in the animal kingdom, but it does happen. We see all the same attributes in the animal kingdom. What we don't see, or at least what we are not able to see, is whether or not they're capable of contemplating their own origins, their own existence. Although I've read some interesting books that speculate on that too. Geez, I can't remember the name of this one book now, but it was very good. This woman was talking about how animals think, and she describes watching a bear sitting and watching the sunset and cocking his head to the left and right and just marveling at the scene, So animals seem to appreciate aesthetics as well. Anyway, it looks like we got a caller on the line. You there, caller?
I'm here, Charlie. Hi, it's Urban.
Oh, hey, how's it going?
Good. How about you?
Urban Jungle Girl, guys. Yeah, not too bad. I haven't talked to you in a while. We've emailed, of course, but.
I know, it's been a while. Well, but I wanted to talk about eugenics. And I hear you bring that term up often.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you're not confusing eugenics with dysgenics.
Well, the whole idea, it kind of goes hand in hand, of genetically creating the superior race and consequentially ridding the world of of all of the in our tribal context, the lesser species really refers to the non-conformance, the non-compliance. That's what Bertrand Russell was talking about,
Well, I've heard you often mention eugenics, and I think the way I hear you say it is often the way Alex Jones has successfully portrayed it after all these decades or whatever. And it's a slamming of eugenics. And I did a show on it and covering some information by Marion Van Court, and I thought it was very good, and I sent it to you, and I think that you didn't listen to it, but you said you did. But anyway, but I do think that you confuse eugenics with dysgenics, and because the idea and the idea of
You know
eugenics
what, Urban?
created.
Sometimes I get so many things in my
I know.
sometimes I'll breeze through something really quick, because I do, I get overwhelmed quite
I
a
know,
bit.
and I assume that as
I think
well,
I do
and
remember
so.
that now, yeah, and I don't think I
Yeah.
listened to the
I know. I knew you were lying to me. But
whole. Well,
anyway, But I think that you should listen to that show that I did, because it was important, because the confusion that's been created about eugenics as opposed to dysgenics is very disturbing to me. And eugenics was a program that was initially created just so that our people, white people, white European people, could manage their population better, so that we wouldn't be breeding people that shouldn't be breeding. I mean, it's a very subtle program. It's not a bad thing. It's not, this whole
Well,
eugenics being
let's put
tied
it this
to
way. Our
they
little.
tied it to genocide. I mean, the
Yeah.
idea that,
In
and
that
that's
sense,
so.
I would say it's a good thing, but unfortunately, the tribe, as always, has hijacked it, and they
Yeah,
use the
sure.
term quite frequently. And when they use it, they don't. It's not a good connotation. It's not.
Well, sure, and
Yeah.
but I think that's how you use it. You use it
Yeah,
in
exactly.
conjunction with a genocide, translation, and that is totally incorrect. It
Right.
vilifies eugenics, which is a very, very good thing.
By the way,
And
this is interesting. That's been big with the elites from the beginning, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies. They sponsored, going back to the late 19th century at least, they were sponsoring yearly meetings, getting together, discussing this very thing with the negative connotations.
of
And
course.
one of the attendees of those meetings was J. Harvey Kellogg, the founder of the, Kellogg cereal empire. He was a Seventh-day Adventist. And I find this most interesting because the beloved prophetess of Adventism, Ellen White, never, ever once made reference. She condemned him for some of his other ideas, like pantheism, for example, right? But she never called him on his eugenics in that context with the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. She never mentioned that at all as being something to be shunned or, again, it just shows Adventists are so stupid. They have no freaking, well, religious people in general, but
Well,
they are
that's.
the most obnoxious to me because they boast that they're the true church. They have no skeletons in their closet. Whatever. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
That's all right. Well, something else that's very important is that the Jews have practiced eugenics forever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they do. But they, it's been vilified for the goyim. For the Gentiles, and
Right.
therein lies the problem. And so when someone like you uses the term eugenics incorrectly, as you do, I so have wanted to talk with you about this, because it's the Alex Jones approach to eugenics, isn't
Yeah,
it?
yeah.
It's this Nazification and the
In
the
and of
Jew
itself, the very
genocide.
word "you" is from, the prefix in the Greek means good. Good birth is what it
That's
means.
right. Good birth is
Yeah.
exactly what it means,
Yeah.
and so that's why we had to have this conversation. And I'm going to send you that show I did again, so that you can listen to that. It's on MightIsRight.net, and I did that. I don't know, sometime earlier this year. But it's important. We need to not confuse our words and our thinking.
To make the
What's
distinction,
important?
yeah.
Yeah, what's in play right now for the white European people is dysgenics, downbreeding, total downbreeding,
Yep.
total, miscegenation of our race, the creation of the mud world. And so it's very, very important that we not get our thinking jumbled any more than it already is. So that's what I wanted to talk about, and that's all I had to say, Charlie. But thanks for taking my call.
No, thanks for
And it
bringing
was
that up.
nice.
That is an important point. We got to make that
It is.
distinction. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it is. So the next time you do it, I'm going to call you. I'll call you
Okay.
again anyway. Okay, Charlie, you take care.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, oh yeah, by all means, folks, anytime an issue like that comes up, I might make a point without really thinking about it, and it needs to be some elaboration. Yeah, by all means, call me on stuff like that. Yeah, no, I'm all for that. I'm not for getting rid of mentally handicapped people, but it would be nice if we could alleviate that kind of thing. That's an example of eugenics. Yeah, preventing births like that. That's why they take blood tests before you get married to see if you're compatible and won't actually produce. If your blood types are such that you could potentially have deformed babies. Here's an example of where the abortion debate gets out of control. Well, there's several examples, but this is one. I'm not for abortion. Absolutely not. Wholesale mass slaughtering of babies is absolutely abominable. It's another thing the tribe has inflicted on us. However, there are instances where abortion, guys, is not only, in my estimation, acceptable, but necessary. Upon getting an ultrasound, if it's discovered that the fetus is severely deformed and that the baby is not going to go full term, and even if it does, it'll probably not survive the birth process, or even if it does, it won't survive for very long. It's going to be a traumatic, painful experience for both, the baby and the parents to have to go through that. It's traumatic enough, if you abort the baby, but it's even worse to have the baby in your arms only to have it die within a day or two, or have it stillborn. Who the hell are you to judge parents who decide, on abortion in a circumstance like that? That's not mass wholesale slaughter of a baby, okay? God damn it. But the fanatic extremist abortionist nutards that like to bomb abortion clinics in the name of saving a baby, they're gonna bomb and kill 10 frickin' people, 10 adults. They would say that no abortion under any circumstance. And usually it's in the name of their wonderful fire-breathing dragon, Yahweh, their goddamn horn fang and claw endowed deity, who actually commanded abortion on numerous occasions in their frickin' holy book, gave a prescription to Moses on how to abort by making up this concoction of herbs. Under no circumstance. But yet, Yah commanded abortion. So once again, here's the Yahwehian exceptionalism. No abortions, except Yahweh says so. No baby killing, except Yahweh says so. No mass murdering, no land stealing, unless Yahweh says so. Take your religion, shove it up your ass, along with your head that's already there. All right, enough of that. But anyway, yeah, thanks to Urban for that. That is an important point. When I use the word eugenics in a negative context, I'm talking about in the context that these bastards use it with their corruption and perversion of it. When they use it, there's no good connotation to it. But yeah, like everything else that they corrupt and pervert, I'd be all for eugenics in that sense, not to wipe out the unfit, but to help prevent in the future using real science for the benefit of man, yes, endowed with compassion. These bastards have no compassion, no consideration. The sick, the weak need to be cared for, not purged from the earth. Oh, you son of a. Oh, let me tell you, folks. My mind is filled with ugly visions that in a former life, I would shun from. I don't shun from it now. I have vivid fantasies of things I'd like to do to these bastards. Anyway, evolutionary theory also legitimizes the survival of the fittest mentality in the business world, or social Darwinism, which is why people like David Rockefeller have endorsed it. For example, the following statement comes from this bastard. This is, let's see. Anyway, this is from, where the hell is this? He made this, this is from some press conference back in the early 70s, anyway. He said, "The growth of a large business is merely the survival of the fittest. The American beauty," talking about a flower, a rose here, "the American beauty could be produced in splendor and fragrance, which brings cheer to the beholder only by sacrificing the buds which grew up around it." It is not a lethal tendency in business. It is merely the working out of the law of nature. You get what he's saying here, the little bastard. You see what he's saying here? He's justifying his and his family's monopolistic tactics of crushing out competition and saying that this is a natural outgrowth of the natural evolutionary process. Through natural selection, we're ridding the lower forms of life, the parasitical forms. Who's the real parasite here, you little bastard? And by the way, survival of the fittest, when it plays out in nature, there's no twisted evil plot behind it. It's just the way it happens. I have bigger teeth, fangs, and claws than you do. Horns, fangs, and claws, and antlers, or whatever. So I'm able to kill you, to survive. No, that's not what plays out in the business world, guys. It's using sleazy tactics, getting government power to back you up, legislation, outright military intervention if necessary, to crush you out, not only economically, but your very life if necessary, if you get in our way enough. Oh, God damn it, man. But nevertheless, guys, he's using evolutionary terminology. They love this stuff. This is why they love it so much. Again, the evolutionists might argue, well, that's just a side issue, but it still stands up scientifically. No, it doesn't. It doesn't, guys. Sorry, it doesn't. You might like it. You might favor it. But for reasons I've already given, it move on, look for something else. Especially when you realize where it actually came from, which I'm going to get to in a minute. I let the cat out of the bag just before the end of the show yesterday, but I didn't actually finish reading the quote. I'm going to read that in a minute. But let me repeat here. While living in London, this is why Karl Marx loved Darwinism so much. While living in London, he attended lectures on evolutionary theory delivered by T.H. Huxley. And I wasn't able to find out if that, guy was, an ancestor of Aldous and Julian, probably about a century earlier. But anyway, Marx immediately fell in love with the concept of evolution, especially as it applied to economics and politics, natural selection or survival of the fittest. Thus, he sent Darwin a copy of Das Kapital in 1873, asking for his endorsement of his work and that he be allowed to dedicate his next work to him. But Darwin declined, fearing that it would give him, a bad name. So we backed away from it. But nevertheless, just look at how evolution goes so completely hand in hand with Marxism, Freemasonry, Fabianism, New Age philosophy, on and on and on and on. All the crap the tribe has introduced to us, it all fits in together because it comes from them. It does. I'm going to demonstrate that in a minute. Anyway. But, and here it is, in fact. Here's the quote. Should you have any remaining doubts that Darwinism is indeed a tribal Jewish supremacist creation, take a look at this quote from the Protocols, ladies and gentlemen. The Protocols of Zion, their blueprint for world domination. Here it is. I didn't have time to finish the quote yesterday. For them, the Goy, let that play the principal part which we have persuaded them to accept as the dictates of science theory. It is with this object in view that we are constantly, by means of our press, arousing a blind confidence in these theories. Holy frickin' crap. You gotta pause just for a moment here. to contemplate what these arrogant bastards are saying. They're talking about pawning off on us scientific theories that they know aren't scientific at all, but they're doing it to frig with our heads so that we will accept other twisted philosophies that are interconnected with these so-called scientific theories, to sell them to us under the brand of science so that they have legitimacy to them. So now our whole way of thinking becomes completely distorted, perverted, and corrupted, just like their sick, mental, defective minds. Once again, listen to what it says. For them, the Goyim, let that play the principal part which we have persuaded them to accept as the dictates of science theory. It is written, excuse me, it is with this object in view that we are constantly, by means of our press, arousing a blind confidence in these theories. They've drilled it into our heads. This is why, guys, once again, when something comes branded with approval for mainstream science, most people automatically say, well, I'm not going to question that. Who am I to question it? The scientists say so. For me, and I hope for you too, when it comes branded with the official approval of officialdom of the scientific world, that's reason to question it. It should be. Who the hell controls mainstream goddamn science? I'm not saying everything they say is crap. No, just like in religion, guys, not everything they say is crap, even though 99.9% not everything they say is crap. You have to mix some lies in there. Even that goddamn book of theirs called the Bible has some truth in it, even though it pains me to say that. Yeah, there is some truth in it. A in fact, the truthful parts are the things that Bible dupes never follow. Anyway, this quote goes on to say, the intellectuals of the Goyim will puff themselves up, oh, and do they ever, will puff themselves up with their knowledge and without any logical verification of it, will put into effect all the information available from science. See? Oh, they're good at it, guys. They will give the impression as though science backs them up. I got to tell you, when I had that post-mortem debate on the Trinity with those couple theology professors there, what a goddamn scam it was. And unfortunately, I was probably the only one in that room that saw through it. The few people that they did allow, that they hand-selected to attend, most of them were their little lackeys. They didn't know much about theology and fancy theological terms, So it went right over their head. And it looked to them like, gee, maybe they're right. Yeah, that makes sense. It didn't make sense, but they used fancy words. For example, this one professor tried to argue the point. He says, haven't you heard of Caldwell's, hypothesis or whatever? It's the idea that the word Elohim in the Hebrew, which is a plural word, a word used for God. And by the way, the word Elohim is not unique to the tribe. It was used before they came along. El or Elohim, it was used by the Canaanites for their tribal deity. That's another thing they stole, just like the name Yahweh, they stole it from the Shasu. Anyway, but he tried to make the point, quoting from the Caldwell hypothesis, that the word Elohim is not only plural, but that it implies three. It's, of course, complete, absolute, frickin' hogwash. It's BS. But by him using that term, that term, the Caldwell hypothesis, the people were, looking around at each other like, oh, yeah, I guess he's got a good argument there. Scientists do the same goddamn thing. They use their complex jargon, and it sucks people in. It has the legitimacy on the surface, the seeming legitimacy of science. Goddamn. This is what this quote is talking about, and I'll begin with it back up.
the feminization of men has been a big part of the Semitic takeover of the European people.
Mindless goddamn drones that can buy into this. Do you know how many billions?
Trump's call on Monday to halt the entrance of Muslims to the U.S. is driving online chatter among white supremacists and is likely...
They're so inundated with the pop culture, and I think people like us are trying to kind of remove ourselves from that.
Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, so anyway, back it up just a bit here in this quote. It says, the intellectuals of the goy will puff themselves up with their knowledge and with many logical, without any logical verification of it, will put into effect all the information available from science, which our agenda specialists, you know, our agents, have cunningly pieced together for the purpose of educating their minds in the direction we want. I strongly encourage you to request these notes. And if nothing else, scroll to the very end. That's where this quote is. Scroll to the very end. I don't even comment after this quote. You don't need comments. It says what it says, and it requires no further comment. Read this quote over and over again. It's rich with meaning. They're boasting here that they are manipulating people, frigging with their heads under the guise of science. Of course they are. They created, once again, guys, the royal... what do you call it? The Royal Society, which since the 17th century has had total control on a global scale of what makes it out to the public regarding science. When something makes it out to the public regarding science, you can bet it's had their approval. And like I said, not everything that has come out of the scientific world is bad, but we have to exercise extreme caution just because Simon says, guys, only do what Simon says. Only do it if Simon tells you. Who do you think invented that little kid's game? Anyways, guys, this quote, you can't miss it. But now it goes on to say this. Do not suppose for a moment that these statements are empty words. Think carefully of the successes we arranged for Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism. You know, Nietzsche, who Hitler was a big fan of. Ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case. I rest my case. Need I say any more? You can either, you know, request these notes or just go up in line and look it up for yourself. Protocols of Learned Elders of Sion, Darwinism. Use those as search words. You'll find this quote yourself. It's in there. Do not suppose for a moment that these statements, that we use science to manipulate public thinking, that these statements are empty words. Think carefully of the success we arranged for Darwinism. Interestingly, the protocols mention Darwinism side by side with Marxism. They go hand in hand. It's the same goddamn philosophy. Oh, they're making monkeys out of us, all right. Anyway, like I said, guys, it's time to move on and look for something else. Look for another theory. That thing comes handed to us with tribal fingerprints all the hell over it. Look at the philosophical implications of it. Guys, even though I know now, took me a long time to figure it out, but even though I know now the Bible is BS and that we may not have a sky fairy that created us. Like I said, I tend to lean in that direction, but I it may not be true. We need to be willing to, you know, come to grips with that idea. This life might be all we have. Given that, let's assume that that is true. I still would never, ever say that life is meaningless and has no purpose. That comes right from the tribe's doorstep, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely do not accept that idea, nor would I ever advocate it. First of all, that gives life a hopeless viewpoint, doesn't it? Yeah, that would encourage somebody who's on the edge to pick up that gun and put it to his or her head. Seriously. For that reason alone, you don't want to say something like that. But even if you're not suicidal, that could lead you to suicide if you keep drilling that into somebody's head. Life is not meaningless. It is not purposeless because we give it meaning and purpose. And if you feel your life doesn't have meaning and purpose, you need to get a little more creative. You can give your life purpose. One of the best ways is to get your attention off yourself and start thinking of other people. You know, give your life purpose by helping people in need. Of course, our little tribal friends and their psychological babble would have you think that that's something that's unhealthy, mentally unhealthy. That's codependency. No, it isn't. When you're doing for something for somebody else, it makes you feel good inside because it's making them feel good. You have purpose and meaning to your life now. That's not unhealthy. It is unhealthy to think along those lines, though. Twisted goddamn psychobabble. Anyway, that concludes our evolution discussion. Like I said, a listener asked me, you know, with Purim coming up, but I forget now. I think it's on the 27th or something next week. He asked if I could do a show on, you know, the Book of Esther. Well, I did do this show a while back, but yeah, maybe it's good to repeat it. And then, of course, I'll follow that up with a discussion of the holiday that's been built up around it. But yeah, it's very interesting. The Book of Esther, which is also called the Megillah Scroll. Remember growing up as a kid, that little cartoon, Megillah the Gorilla? Oh, so many things that didn't make sense now. Didn't make sense then that makes sense now. I never knew. I just thought it was just some name that they made up because it rhymes with gorilla, right? Megillah, guys. Who came? Oh, my God. Something else I found out recently. It's a show I'm working on right now. In the course of researching this show, the name Man Ray came up. Literally, this was somebody's name. His first name was Man. His last name was Ray. Man Ray. I'm like, what? You got to be kidding me. I took a second look. I'm like, sure enough, that was the guy's name, Man Ray. Any of you who ever had kids back in the, well, even now, like the show is still going, but I don't know if this character still appears in the show, but the early episodes of SpongeBob used to have this arch villain that would make appearances from time to time on the show. His name was Man Ray. Well, what do you know about that? They actually took the name from this real-life character who was one sick, twisted bastard. I'll be covering that on a future show. Guys, it's unbelievable. Cartoons, man, they really frig with your head. There's a lot of stuff that rears its ugly heads. It rears its ugly head in kids' cartoons. That not only kids, but most adults have no idea about. It tells you the twisted mentality these bastards have. Remember as a kid growing up, the sinister character, you know, almost always wanted to rule the world. Even cartoons today, you know, feature that same thing. I remember Underdog had that character, Simon Sinister. Remember him? I'm going to rule the world. That's exactly what they're working toward, isn't it? They always put their little theme in there. Anyway, the Book of Esther is interesting because over the centuries, there's been a lot of debate as to whether or not the damn thing even belongs in there. I'll get into this later. We'll talk about Martin Luther, for example. But even Tex Mars, in a more modern context, Tex Mars doesn't like the Book of Esther. He thinks it doesn't belong in the Bible. Of course, you know, the whole goddamn Bible doesn't belong, does it? But nevertheless, he recognizes there's something wrong there. The book, actually, is a secular document. It doesn't even mention the word God once. And who cares if it did, because that word is an evil freaking monstrosity anyway, what it represents. But nevertheless, it's, what is it doing in a, what's supposed to be a religious book? There's nothing religious there at all. It doesn't mention the word Yahya or Elohim even once. Not even an allusion there to. Very interesting. So for that reason, you know, Tex questions it. And I'm glad he does, but Tex, why aren't you questioning the whole goddamn thing? I should get Vortex on sometime soon here. He's getting up there in age. I guess his health is kind of failing now. Poor guy, you know, I think if he was around with us, if he was younger and, you know, going to be with us for another decade or two, I think there would be a good chance of bringing him around. I'd like to sit, not on the air, you know, I wouldn't want to put him in an awkward position. I'd like to sit down with him alone, the two of us, and have a talk. Anyway, one has to wonder how the Book of Esther, as I said, ever even wound up in this damn book called the Bible, when it's not religious, doesn't mention the word God. It is, therefore, unquestionably just a, you know, a secular document, filled with a lot of hyperbole, exaggeration, ridiculous nonsense, like all the other books in that damn collection of nonsense. But once again, it's not religious by any means. Neither is, for that matter, the what is it? Song of Solomon, I believe, also does not mention the word God or you know, Yahweh, Elohim, whatever, Lord. It's not there. Another weird book. It's more of a pornographic novel, really, if you look at it. Solomon's talking about, you know, I lavish myself with your succulent breasts, or however the hell he puts it. What the hell? Are you freaking kidding me? Of course, there's other books that have pornographic segments in them, too. I pointed that out on a previous show. Sex in the Bible. If you didn't catch that show, you know, you can request the notes. I'll send them to you. There's a lot of sick, twisted, perverted crap in that book, man. I'm talking, you know, sexual perversion now. It's perverted across the board, but there's a lot of sexual perversion in that goddamn thing. Again, you got to love it. You know, the same parents who won't let their kids go see an R-rated movie, they'll hand them that book. Oh, no, that movie has too much sex in it. Oh, really? Have you looked at your holy book lately? That movie has too much violence in it. Oh, really? I'm all for parents not wanting their kids to see violence and sex in movies. But, my God, you're going to turn around and give them that frickin' book? You'd be better off letting them watch some Hollywood movies rather than give them that damn thing. That'll corrupt their minds far worse. It's already corrupted yours, Mom and Dad. Anyway, as we'll see, this book is a very ugly secular book because of the horrors that it has inspired throughout history, as well as the horrors it continues to inspire. And yet, young kids are taught the hideous story of Esther in Sunday school classes or Sabbath school, whatever, as though, you know, there's some godly or moral lesson to be found therein, when in reality, it reeks with immorality and treachery. That's all that lies behind the story of this goddamn book. And yet, oh, they've got a whole holiday dedicated to this story, you know, the Purim holiday. What a wonderful thing it is, the triumph of our people, you know, on and on and on. Guys, the story is horrific. A story of treason, treachery, deception, betrayal, and mass freaking murder. Like so many accounts in the Bible, it's not known with any degree of certainty whether or not this book has any truth to it whatsoever. If there even was a queen called Esther, certainly the book is in line with how the tribe has worked down through the centuries. Oh, yeah, they have one of the little bitches marry a king so they could influence the throne and bend the king toward their wishes. Yeah, they did do that type of thing. But specifically, the queen named Esther, did she exist? Who the frig knows? We have no record, like just about every other story in that goddamn book of nonsense. No record of the great Jesus. You got to love that one. The biggest star of all in this drama. No record whatsoever. Don't even cite the Josephus crap. Forget it. So like I said, there's no record. And guys, let me remind you, we have more records that have survived to our day from the ancient world, from the first century, than we do from any other period in history. You know, from the ancient world. From the first century. And yet, we have no reference in any of these thousands of documents and fragments of documents. We have no reference at all to this man named Jesus. Not one. That is very problematic. Wouldn't you think that the great Yahya would have given us something more to go by than just these contradictory frickin' goddamn gospel accounts that nobody can rely on, that has a brain that thinks and actually looks at them for what they are and sees them for the collection of contradictory, fairy tale nonsense? Didn't even leave us anything so we could be certain that there actually at least even was a person named Jesus? We can't actually confirm that he existed. When you look at the historical context like I did, something Bible believers tell you you need to do to properly interpret scripture, but they never do, because if they did, they'd see that Jesus was a goddamn insurrectionist. When you do look at the gospel accounts, that's all you can walk away with. Yeah, the context he arose in was, false messiahs or whatever, false, as if there's such thing as a true, but you know what I mean. All these messianic claimants arising, using religion as a tool to manipulate. Sure. The evidence is right there in those gospel accounts that he was just another example of one of them. But the thing is, the gospel accounts aren't consistent. They contradict each other. God damn it. I it's amazing. The biggest star in the Bible. And we have no way of knowing if he ever actually even existed. Holy gee. Do you see what Bible dupes are doing? The heavy weight that they're resting on that cracked goddamn foundation, cracked, it's frickin' pulverized. And yet Jesus says, in following me, you're building on the rock instead of the sand. Oh, sure you are. Sure you are. Oh, and by the way, happy Easter, everybody. Yeah, that's coming up Sunday, isn't it? Oh, wow. I hope you all bought, a couple big planks of wood and some big, railroad spikes and found somebody to help you kneel yourself to that cross Sunday. You can do the first wrist yourself. The second one you're going to need some help with, though. So, get a volunteer. Pay him a few bucks, whatever. And do it in the town square so everybody can see, like that guy in the Philippines. Or, it still isn't too late, you can catch a flight over to the Philippines and join that guy. Oh, my God. Gee. I might get together with family, but, just as a chance to catch up on what's going on with my siblings, my father, That's it. Holiday has no meaning for me whatsoever. In fact, I detest what it represents. And hopefully you do too. Anyway, the Book of Esther has been treated by so many for so long as being true, and its message has been endorsed and put into practice for so long that it may as well be considered true. Certainly, the essence of it is true, since it demonstrates how many elite Jewish pigs have operated throughout the millennia. Anyway, if authentic, this book is believed to have been written around 485 to 464 BC during the reign of King Ahasuerus, roughly concurrent with the reign of Xerxes I in Persia. Both names are even somewhat phonetically similar. Many scholars dispute the authenticity of this book, even Bible-believing scholars. Only the first part is found in the Greek Septuagint, and it's the only book of the Tanakh not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it looks like even Jews of the, first century BC and the first century AD of the Qumran sect, it looks like they didn't even accept the Book of Esther as inspired. Ah, what do you know about that? It's also important to note that no author of the New Testament ever cited the Book of Esther even once or even alluded to it. How the hell did this thing... I can tell you how, through the tribe. But, how have Christian dupes bought this thing? They must love it, guys. They sit back. Look at this, our number one sick and twisted playbook here, which shows how we operate, how sinister we are. We got them to embrace it and think it's something good, like so much other crap they pawned off on us over the years. Because of discrepancies in Hebrew texts, Saint Jerome, one of the early church fathers, divided this book, the Book of Esther, into the older and newer parts when he organized his Latin Vulgate Bible in the late 4th century. Interestingly, the first time the word Jew or Judean is used in the Bible, rather than Hebrew or Israelite, is in the Book of Esther. Set in Persia, the story incorporates key elements of Persian paganism. Fertility rites always occur in spring, and so does Purim, which is based around the story of Esther, which ultimately is where the Easter celebration itself comes from, guys. The whole damn thing is, again, it's pure paganism. The time they observe it, you know, especially in the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox, you know, preceded by a 40-day fasting period. Where the hell do they get that from? Don't give me the BS that, oh, they get it from when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. Ah, knock it off. That has nothing to do with the last 40 days of his life preceding the alleged crucifixion. Nothing. There was a fertility cult spread all over the earth in ancient times that had such a festival, 40-day fasting period preceding the great fertility festival in the spring. Anyway. Oh, excuse me. God, I hate this one. This holiday, if you will, falls on the Hebrew calendar date of the 14th of Adar. Because the Hebrew calendar is lunar, this holy day usually falls in March, sometimes in April. It appears that the purpose of the Book of Esther was to establish Purim, a holiday where Jews have traditionally ruthlessly struck out at their enemies, those that have exposed them and resisted them and kicked their asses out, or at least severely restricted, like the Byzantines, what could be done on their turf. We need to understand that when the elite Jews talk about their enemies, guys, once again, what they really mean, again, is those who expose their crimes and get in the way of them. In Hebrew, Purim means lots. Purim was named after the lottery, if you will, that Haman used to choose the day that he planned to massacre, allegedly, all the Jews throughout the First Empire. All right, guys, pick up there when we get back. My body started shaking and I can't take no more.
I want to be a girl.
Okay, little Jimmy. As a 4-year-old child, I trust your judgment to make life-altering decisions about your body and gender. But where can I get some help for this?
Well, we can help. Here at the Michelle Obama Academy for Transgender Children, we will convince you and your child that gender is just a social construct. Bruce Jenner knows that just because you were born with a penis, that doesn't mean you need to be a boy. It means that you need to chop it off and get a neo-vagina. At Michelle Obama's Academy for Transgender Kids, we know the importance of chopping off genitals.
Crumbles to the... This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, welcome back. Anyway, I said allegedly that Haman, you know, had chosen by lot the day that he planned to massacre all the Jews throughout the Persian Empire. Allegedly, because if there's any truth to the story, you can bet your sweet fat fanny that this was nothing but goddamn proper freaking ganda. You know, a 5th century B.C. version of the Holocaust myth. Jesus Christ. Look at the parallels, guys. Haman probably was fed up with their B.S. and was trying to get the king to pass a law to prevent them from continuing with their economic shenanigans. And so they had to make him out to look like this, you know, ethnic cleanser. He's evil. We got to kill him and all of his buddies. They created a Holocaust. In that sense, I bet there is some truth to this goddamn story. They created a Holocaust under the pretext of preventing him from creating a Holocaust, and when all he wanted to do was stop them from their trail of crimes. Goddamn son of a bitch. That's all the Holocaust was, guys. Demonizing the Germans because they wouldn't let them muscle in on their turf and stick their greedy little grubby fingers in on their economic empire that they had built for themselves. They lusted after the German economic empire. It was number one in Europe at the time of, the early 20th century. And indeed, going back into the 19th, too. It was an economic giant. And they couldn't get their fingers in the pie. So they became an enemy. Turned all of Europe against them. And indeed, the U.S. as well. The little lackeys. All the countries that had central banks. And to this day, most people think of Germany as at least a potential threat. We got to keep our eye on that country. It could rise up again. Holy Christ. And yet, if you mentioned the real enemy in that war, the one who started the whole goddamn thing in the first place, in a negative context, oh, you're so prejudiced. You know how many times I've been criticized over the years? People find out, you know, you've got a radio show, and they go and look up my show, and now I'm demonized. I can't believe it. You're so radical. You're insane. You're so filled with hate. But yet, if I talked about Muslims in the same context, I talk about these bitches and bastards, they'd have no problem, guys. They might think, well, I don't like some of the language you've used over the years, the foul language. But, you know, I can understand. Oh, you're so right. If I talked about Muslims, they'd be right on board with me. Don't you love the goddamn hypocrisy? Don't you love it? Anyway, Haman, according to the Book of Esther, was a noble and vizier of the Persian Empire under King Ahasuerus. He was supposedly a descendant of Agag, the king of the Amalekites, which were traditional enemies of the heebie-jeebies that were supposedly wiped out by Kings David and Solomon. You got to love it. The Amalekites are the ones that you know, at least half a dozen times, were said to have been wiped out. And then a few chapters later, oh, there they are again. The Hebes are waging war against them. And supposedly they wiped them out. Not one was left. And then a few chapters later, they emerge again. Remember I did that frickin'... I did that show on, you know, Yahweh's kills, going through the entire Bible and listing all of the, you know, the massacres that he ordered. Not only, you know, is it horrific to see what a bloodthirsty, tyrannical bastard Yahweh is, but you look at these stories and all the goddamn ridiculous contradictions of them. Bible dupes, have you ever, ever stopped to really look at your book? God damn it, what a collection of filth. And just ridiculous, inconsistent, contradictory BS, the whole fucking thing. Oh, they've made monkeys out of us, all right, in so very many ways. When are we going to put to bed once and for all of their propaganda? Anyway, according to the story, Haman never succeeded because one of King Ahasuerus' wives, the little Jewish bitch Esther, the Barbara Spector of her day, got the king to murder Haman and his 10 co-conspirators. Yeah, who's the real conspirator here? We'll discuss this in more detail shortly. But let's first look at the celebration of Purim itself. On the day of Purim, the Talmud gives permission, even encouragement, to getting drunk and to cursing at, reviling, and spitting upon Gentiles and Christians specifically. Anyway, hate to say it, guys, but in many ways, Christians, most of them down to the centuries, have deserved to be reviled and spit upon, but not by these bastards. By Gentiles for their hypocrisy, their tribal ass-kissing, their BS finger-pointing hypocritical bullcrap, you know, on and on and on. But anyways, at the beginning of the Purim celebration, the entire book of what we call Esther, again called Megillah by the Jews, which simply means scroll in Hebrew. But every Purim, the book of Esther or Megillah is read in the synagogue. It is so sacred to them. And it has become sacred to the mindless goy dupes that embrace their holy book. Actually, the Megillah contains not just the book of Esther, but some commentary on the Purim celebration. Anyway, the Purim service is held in the evening after the beginning of the new Jewish day, which begins after sunset, commemorating Esther's deadly after-dark dinner party. Jewish women are rabbinically required to attend the Purim celebration service. In older times, and where it was tolerated, as in the ghettos and shtetls or shtetls, loud, boisterous street parties went on for much of the night with dancing, singing, and drunken carousing, concluding with the burning of Haman in effigy. Isn't that interesting? Is this where the idea of the cremation of care comes from at the Bohemian Grove, albeit they use an effigy of a child? Sick, twisted, frickin' swine. Anyway, the Talmud Bavli gives the following details regarding the proper observance of this holy day, along with a few other revealing details about Purim. All are obligated, it says, in the reading of the Megillah. That's from Orach Chaim 689. It also says the Jew is to say on Purim day, cursed be all non-Jews. Blessed be all Jews, according to Orach Chaim 660 and 16. According to Megillah 7b, quote, Rava said, you know, they're quoting from rabbis with their commentaries here. It is duty of a man to get drunk with wine on Purim until he cannot tell the difference between cursed be Hannah, or cursed be Haman, and blessed be Mordecai, Esther's cousin. Rava and Rabbi Zerah joined together in a Purim feast. They became drunk, and Rabba arose and cut Rabbi Zerah's throat. Oh, this is nice. On the next day, he prayed on his behalf and revived him, revived him back to life. I'll cut your throat today and revive you back to life tomorrow. What the hell is this twisted crap? Next year, he, Rabba, said, will your honor come and we will have the Purim feast together? He, Rabbi Zerah, answered, a miracle does not take place on every occasion. Whatever. In other words, it's a miracle you rose me back to life, but the miracle of me actually showing up, participating, is not likely to happen. Whatever, man. Is that supposed to be a version of their twisted, frickin' mentally defective humor or something? Who knows? Anyway, nevertheless, that's what's recorded in their sick, twisted Megillah scroll. Let's look for a minute at what Martin Luther said about the Book of Esther. Always called the Megillah and ranked right alongside the Torah by the Jews. Esther is actually the name given by Christian translators, but is not found in the Megillah itself. More on that later. Anyway, since it does not appear in the late 4th century BC Septuagint, and since St. Jerome worked with confusing manuscripts in the late 4th century AD, we see a time frame when the Talmudists put the final touches on the Megillah. So even if there was any truth to the story, a lot of embellishments took place in the early centuries as the Talmud was being committed to parchment. It had mostly only been handed down verbally up to that time. Anyway, while Jerome's Bible contained the Book of Esther, the 16th century reformer Martin Luther was very critical of it, saying that it was of little value. Well, again, the whole goddamn thing is of little value, no value. Anyway, speaking in regards to the Book of Esther, in his book on the Jews and their lies, Luther wrote, quote, they are real liars and bloodhounds who have not only continued, not only continually perverted and falsified all of Scripture with their mendacious glosses from the beginning until the present day, their hearts' most ardent slighting and yearning and hoping is set on the day on which they can deal with us, meaning Gentiles, as they did with the Gentiles in Persia at the time of Esther. Well, he got that right. Oh, how fond they are of the Book of Esther, which is so beautifully attuned to their bloodthirsty, vengeful, murderous yearning and hope. The sun has never shone on a more bloodthirsty and vengeful people than they are, who imagined that they are God's people, who have been commissioned and commanded to murder and to slay the Gentiles. Again, this is a great quote. It's commendable. It's all true. But let's not forget, guys, who this guy actually was, who his paymasters were. God damn it. Once again, it's like reading Churchill's frickin' famous quote about, you know, the Jews that are ruling the world, the international Jew, and they're behind the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, blah, blah, blah. All true, great quote, but he was one of their biggest whores and probably was a crypto himself. So it is here with Mr. Martin Luther. Sorry, Bible dupes out there that like to wet your panties over this guy and think he was a great hero of the Reformation. He was one of them. That's why he lived till his dying day. He was the chief arch-heretic of his day, right? They were killing Protestant reformers left and right, roasting them on the barbie constantly, and yet this guy walked scot-free, just like goddamn Castro in the Cold War, right? How is it? Every other leader they wanted dead, or at least wanted removed from power, they got their wishes 5 minutes after they thought the idea up. But this guy, supposedly, according to CIA, 60 attempts were made on his life and they could never take him out. Guys, he was a goddamn Sephardim. That ends the debate right there. There's your answer. Anyway, the official story in the Book of Esther goes like this. Our leading lady joins King Ahasuerus' harem. She keeps her Hebrew origins a secret. How typical. Yet one of the Jews, our male protagonist, Mordecai, her cousin, is a prominent man in the Persian government, we're told. Mordecai, a dedicated friend of his fellow tribe members, has a sworn enemy, a classic anti-Semite, Haman. While his motive is not stated in the Book of Esther, Haman clearly despises the Jews and does everything he can to harm and or thwart them. Well, again, the harm part, I guarantee you guys, that was added in. He wasn't out to kill all the Jews. Neither was Hitler. I'm no fan of Hitler, but his aim was simply to get them out of, you know, German finance, out of German government, to get them out of the country. Can you blame them? And when that wasn't working, they kept getting sent back. Well, okay, we'll put the bastards to work. Can you blame them? I don't blame them. Put them to work. Put them in labor camps. They simply turned around and made it out like he was a mass murderer and wanted to kill them all. No, he didn't. In fact, once again, guys, does it even make sense? When you're fighting a major war on several different fronts and it's costing every penny, every resource at your disposal, are you really going to take the time to mass murder a bunch of people? Not only is that going to cost a lot of money and a lot of manpower, taking away from the war effort, but why? Why kill them when, you know, the ultimate get-even policy would be to force them into labor to support your war effort? That's much more ingenious, much more practical, much more sensible. He's not going to want to not only waste all that money and time killing people when he needs that money and time and effort and resources for the war, but he's going to put that human resource, if you will, to work. Hey, they've been enslaving us. Let's enslave the bastards back. Now, again, that policy sucks because there were innocent people targeted in it. And it wasn't just tribe members that were in those camps either, you know. But nevertheless, look how they demonized him as a mass murderer guy simply because he was wise to them. He was onto the little game, exposing them and preventing them from continuing with their game. Of course, I'll argue, as I have, you know, that ultimately, whether he knew it or not, he was, you know, their best servant during World War II. He served their interests most handsomely. Anyway, we're told that Haman eventually, or Mordecai eventually persuaded the king to sign a decree of extermination, a holocaust of ancient times, holocaust of Gentiles. If there's any truth to this story, this part about Haman's anti-Semitism. Oh, I'm sorry. This was Haman. This wasn't Mordecai. Mordecai came into the picture after. Haman was the one, you know, according to this obvious fictitious story, that tried to get the king to sign papers, you know, to ordain, you know, a holocaust of the Jews. Let's kill them off. Let's get rid of them all. No. Nope. Not buying it. Again, if there's any truth to this story, and there may very well be some truth to it, this part, guys, they made up once again. Haman, I guarantee you, was simply speaking out against their economic and political wheelings and dealings. He was trying to get the king to pass laws, just like the Byzantines wisely did, to stop them, to prevent them from being able to exert an influence in government and finance. And now they made him out to be an ethnic cleanser, or at least a potential ethnic cleanser. So before he kills all of us, O king, you gotta kill him and all of his buddies. Anyway. The truth is more likely, again, that Haman was exposing their crimes, and that's why they wanted him out of the way. Yeah, kill him before he gets the word out. Kill him and all of his buddies. And so they wanted him dead and all of his buddies. And they achieved this goal by massive lies to gain sympathy from the goy, as though they were victims or potential victims of a hate crime. How classic, guys. How classic. Let's jail anybody, not only those that don't like us and speak out against our crimes, but those who expose our lies too. Like in Germany, talk about their Holocaust lie, you'll go to jail for 2 years. Once again, I got to ask the question, doesn't that tell you right there, before you even look at the Holocaust story, doesn't that tell you right there that it's BS? If you have to pass a law that silences someone for questioning something, that something they're questioning must in fact be a lie by default. If you need laws in place to silence people like that who question it, if your goddamn story was true, you wouldn't need to silence people and lock them up. God damn it, how stupid can people be to fall for this? How can you even allow a law like that to exist and persist, though? That's what amazes me. Look what they've done to Germany. They've castrated them. That law shouldn't have even been in place at all. It should have been struck down before it even came up for vote. How in the hell can you ever, even if that goddamn story was true, how could you ever embrace a law that would jail somebody? But I'll tell you now, if it was true, you wouldn't have a law. There'd be no need for one. But again, just for the sake of argument, even if the goddamn story was true, how could you ever be for locking someone up who questioned the truth? Who cares? Let them talk about it. In fact, you'd want them to, just so they could make the asses out of themselves that they are, right? What the hell would you care? Anyway, by this time in our story, one heroine called Queen Esther, heroine, having progressed from mere Oriental harem prostitute to the position of chief wife, enters into the picture. Anyway, to make a long story short, she interceded with her charms and the king granted the comely concubine's request. Thus, he and Queen Esther stopped the Purim pogrom and alleged extermination of the Jews planned by Haman, the wicked anti-Semite. Haman was consequently hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. With the death threat behind them, the Jews rejoice with feasts and merriment, we're told. Along with these festivities, they set about causing the extermination of their enemies. Imagine that. On the one hand, we're told that they stopped an alleged massacre of themselves, and now let's turn around and massacre everybody that knew somebody else who knew somebody that was remotely involved in this alleged plot that we made up that wasn't even true. Let's go kill them all. God damn it, guys. Where do we see a parallel like this in history? What other group of people was persecuted on a small scale early on, but then later, once they came to power, mass murdered everybody that even looked at them funny? Can you guess? Christians have done the same goddamn thing, following right in the path of those who spawned them, of course. Where do you think they learned that from? Oh, poor us, we've been persecuted. But once we get into power, we're going to be the persecutors. And boy, did they persecute for over 1,500 freaking years. Tortured and mass slaughtered everyone and anyone that even looked at them funny. You didn't even have to do or say anything. All you had to do was have somebody start a rumor about you that didn't like you. And that was enough to get you caught up in the goddamn machine. Anyway, even though by this time in our story the threat was over, there was no more call for execution of the tribe, supposedly, as if that story was even true in the first place. But nevertheless, by this point, the threat is over, right? Are they happy with that? Nope. Let's go kill everybody now. And why did they want to kill them, guys? Because these people were aware of their shenanigans. We got to kill them all off so no one is left to expose us so that we can engage in our frickin' schemes, raping and pillaging this nation, draining its coffers dry, driving into poverty everybody, making them homeless, jobless, while we suck up all the wealth, just like we did in Egypt. And then later we'll turn, the Greeks against these Persians, and then we'll turn the Romans against them. God damn it. Anyway, this killing spree on the first Purim sprang solely from cold-blooded revenge, not only for something that never happened, but for something that undoubtedly was never even planned in the first frickin' place. Anyway. Oh, another break coming in, guys. Pick up then we get back.
Hello everyone, Kyle Hunt here, founder of Renegade Broadcasting. I hope you're enjoying all of the free content we have here. The reality is that it's free for you, but not free for us. Putting on all of these shows day after day, night after night, does take time and money.
Sean Surplus is here with me for every show, working as our audio engineer to ensure high-quality production. Why not help him out by sending him a donation? Click on his picture in the lineup to get to his archive page, then click on the donate button. Your donations will help us to upgrade, expand, and keep pushing forward. Thank you for supporting Sean's hard work.
Guys, welcome back. So anyway, to carry out this slaughter, Esther first had the king invite Haman to an evening state dinner where they would unexpectedly attack him when he was off guard. Oh, isn't that a classic tribal maneuver? Not only is this Hebrew harlot revered in Jewish circles, but in Christian circles, of course, as well. And among members of the woman's version of Freemasonry, the Eastern Star. Let's have a look at what the Bible says happened next regarding the brutal, bloody events following Esther's cowardly conspiracy to slay Haman. The adversary, an alleged would-be exterminator of the Jews. Yeah, whatever, man. God damn, this story, guys, it's so parallel with the Holocaust BS. Can't miss it. Anyway, here's what the Book of Esther says here in the Megillah Scroll. It says, then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he that would presume to do this, that is, to kill all the Jews? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was in terror before the king and queen, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. Oh, yeah, they got their rocks off watching that. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews for the fear of the Jews. Imagine that. They didn't declare themselves Jews because they sympathized, oh, these poor people. They were afraid of them. Look at the power they have. Wow, we better go along with them, kissing their ass. Instead of rising up against the little weaselly bastards, they kissed their ass out of fear. For it says, fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. And soon there came a day when the Jews should get the mastery over their foes. And the Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on such as sought their hurt. We're going to go out and slaughter everybody now who was even remotely tied in with Haman and his buddies. Imagine that, guys, a mass goddamn slaughter. Everybody was in fear now. Oh, don't stand up to the... They get off on this. They get off on it. They absolutely love it. They always have through history. That's why I say there has to be some truth to this story, because it's so fully in line with how they operate. And always have. And they could make no stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen upon all peoples. So the Jews smote all of their enemies with the sword, slaughtering and destroying them, and they did as they pleased to those who hated them. God damn it. In Susa, the capital itself, it says, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman. Didn't matter to them whether those sons were actually in league with Haman or not. Agreed with Haman. You know, you're his sons? Oh, we're going to kill you. You're his next door neighbor? Oh, we're going to kill you. Oh, you once sold him a bag of cookies? We're going to kill you. It goes on to say, now the other Jews were in the king's provinces. The other Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered together and got relief from their enemies and slew 75,000 of those who hated them. 75,000. And on the 14th day, they rested and made that day of feasting and gladness. Made that a day of feasting and gladness. So there was your first Purim celebration. What does it look back to? A lie, a Holocaust-type lie that they made up, making themselves out as victims when they were the victimizers, and making the victims out to look like they were the victimized. Oh, yes, 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 yes. A 5th century BC phony Holocaust BS story. This is where it started, guys. Well, it worked for us so good in the past. We will do it again. That was their attitude back in World War II. We'll make up another lie again, like it's worked so well for us before. Ah, yes. You see why I say they love Adolf Hitler, guys? They love him. Just like they love Jesus. Don't fall for their BS when they attack him and cut him down. Well, I mean, they hated him for rising up and bringing the Romans in. Sure, yeah. There's a genuine hatred there. They see him as a traitorous Jew. But they love the mileage they've gotten out of him. Are you freaking kidding me? That's why Josephus took this religion along with Paul and ran off with it the way that he did. Wow, we can manipulate the goy like never before in ways that we never could have imagined. Anyway. The only difference with Hitler, between Hitler and Christ, though, is Christ did betray them. Hitler didn't betray them, guys. The lower-level Jews weren't happy. They wound up in concentration camps. But the top elite Zio pig Jews, they loved the bastard. They didn't wind up in camps now, did they? How many Jewish bankers wound up in Nazi concentration camps, folks? Ask yourself that one. Anyway, but, you know, this slop is taught to children. Can you believe this? To demonstrate to them how God brings victory to his people who trust in him. Well, yeah, that is how that God operates, that psychopathic bastard. That is how he operates, isn't it? He goes after innocent people all through this whole damn book, right? That's the tribal mentality for you. And when you embrace their book and their God, you're embracing their same twisted, mentally defective, inhuman, despicable type of behavior. God damn it, don't tell me you're Jew-wise if you fall for this book, for this God, for this religion. You're not. 'Such a God can only be called the devil, ladies and gentlemen. And that's exactly what Yahweh is. Like I said, I'm not for devil worship, Satanism. No, of course not. It's freaking evil. That comes to us from the tribe too, doesn't it? But the character in the Bible called the devil, not as he's worshipped under that name, no. But the character in the Bible called the devil, how bad could that character really be if he's the antithesis of Yahweh? You understand what I'm saying? Yahweh himself is the devil. They always demonize that which is good and make good out of that which is evil. So, you know, if there is a devil character, how bad can he be? both Esther and several passages from the Talmud, Bavli, affirm, endorse, and sanction tribal bloodlust and ethnic cleansing, ladies and gentlemen. If you want justification for arrogant, zio pig actions of vengeance against the Palestinian people, look no further than the story of Esther. If you want, you know, so-called justification, put that word in quotes. That's where they find it from. In Hickok Megillah 2:18, we read, for example, all the books of the prophets and all the writings will be annulled in the days of the Messiah, except for the book of Esther. It will continue to be binding like the five books of Moses and the entire oral law, which will never be invalidated. Even though all memory of our suffering will be erased, still the days of Purim will not be annulled. As it is written, these days of Purim will not pass away from the Jews, and its memory will never leave their descendants. And then they cite Esther 9:25. Unfreaking believable. So this book is of utmost importance to them. Yeah, it sums up their psychopathic mentality, doesn't it? It's all there. The treason, the betrayal, the lies, the deception, the conniving, the manipulation, the mass murdering, the false attribution of victimization and you know, making the victims out to be the victimizers, on and on, you know, and the opposite of that, making the victimizers out to look like victims. It's all there, guys. This is their goddamn playbook. How to hijack a nation, how to twist its laws, how to get the goy to do your fighting for you. All of their sick and twisted goddamn evil crap. It's all in this book. It's all there. No wonder they said, if all the other books disappear, this one won't. This one we're going to hold true to the very end. It'll always be our guidebook. Yeah, absolutely. And yet it's the one book that, you know, technically doesn't even belong in the goddamn Bible. It wasn't even in their early Bible, if you will. It wasn't found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, was it? They recognize it wasn't a religious book. Doesn't even mention the word God. And yet, here's the rabbis of the Talmud saying that it's the most important of all their books. The same rabbis, you know, who have always been for world domination. That's all they talk about in the goddamn Talmud, right? Wow. That says it all right there. Can you not see that the problems with modern Judaism do not just stem from the Talmud or the Kabbalah or the Zohar, ladies and gentlemen, but from the goddamn Old Testament as well? It is an abomination. And by default, of course, the New Testament as well grew right out of the Old Testament. If you accept the new, you have to accept the old. I love these Christian mindless asses that actually claim that, you know, I reject the Old Testament. I only follow the new. Oh, and exactly how is it that you think you can get away with that? Goddamn New Testament not only grew out of the Old Testament and all of its philosophy stems from that, but you are commanded in the New Testament to follow and embrace the old. Jesus himself said it. You stupid asses. Anyway, the text of Esther affirms not only the alleged right of the Jews to self-defense, but their right to utter vengeance and death over their opponents. It is a memorial of destruction, a guidebook of destruction. As Esther 8, verses 11 to 13 states, by these decrees, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather together and defend their lives. Defend from what? At this point, the decree had been canceled. There was not going to be any slaughter. There was no defense. Of course, again, there never was any real decree for slaughter. Guys, they frickin' made the story up. But it doesn't matter, even if the story was true. By this time, there was no more threat, right? What's to defend? They wanted to kill him because these people knew their game and could pose a threat to them, could prevent them, like Haman tried to do. We got to kill them all. According to this book of nonsense, tens of thousands were slaughtered, right? I wouldn't be surprised if that were true. I don't doubt it for a minute. It's how they've always worked, these rotten, sleazy, scoundrelous, wretched, treasonous bastards. By these decrees, the king allowed the Jews, it says, who were in every city, to gather together and defend their lives, to destroy, to slay, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, with their children and women, and to plunder their goods upon one day throughout all the provinces. Oh, they had a heyday, didn't they? Notice, it didn't just say to slay them or to annihilate or, you know, to destroy. It used all of those words. The person who wrote this was getting off on it. It would be enough to say to destroy them, wouldn't it? Or to slay them or to annihilate. No, they had to use all three. Destroy, slay, and annihilate. Because they're getting off on this. Kill, crush, destroy, massacre, and loot. Just like all the stories were told in the Torah, right? Moses and Joshua. Guys, those stories are true. Oh, I not all the stupid, ridiculous, fancy fairy tale, aspects of them. No. But the stories of the mass slaughter and the looting, they did happen. We have an archaeological record of it. After the Hyksos were expelled from Egypt, they went into Canaan and raided multiple cities, slashed and burned as they went. We have the archaeological evidence of that. The passage continues. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, the Jews were to be ready to avenge themselves upon their enemies. Notice, avenge. What was to be avenged here? Again, even if it was true that they were supposed to have been slaughtered, the king reversed the decree, right? How can you avenge something that never even happened? Once again, guys, the story isn't even true. There was no plan to mass slaughter them. But even if there was, how could they avenge something that never even goddamn happened? Oh, I'm telling you guys, search as you may, you will never, ever find any group of peoples, religious, ethnic, or otherwise, ideological, that could ever compare to these bastards and their evil frickin' crimes that are piled higher than the heavens. Throughout all of human history, there's never been the likes of them, ever. Ever. And the bastards have always gotten away with it, still do. You not only can't expose this to most mindless mutton-chomping goy, but you'll be labeled as a bigot and, you know, God damn it. In the Apocrypha, the uncanonized books, there are found additional parts of chapter 10 through 16 of Esther, which are not found in the Septuagint. This extra material clearly affirms the same psychopathic psychodynamics of bitter revenge. The Apocryphal Book of Esther, chapter 10, verses 23 and 24, for example, has this to say. Let's see, how much time do we... Oh, yeah, we got time. It says that both now and hereafter there may be safety to us and the well-affected Persians, but to those which do conspire against us as a memorial of destruction. In other words, You kiss our ass, we'll let you live. But if you threaten or ever have threatened, or even look like you might threaten in the future to try to expose our criminal activity so we can't get away with our shenanigans, we're going to kill you. Or have our goyim mindless drones kill you for us, whichever. Therefore, it says, every city and country whatsoever which shall not do according to these things shall be destroyed without mercy with fire and sword, and shall be made not only unpassable for men, but also most hateful to wild beasts and fowls forever. You better go along with us, or we're going to slaughter you. This is why it said the Persians converted to Judaism out of fear. I don't doubt it. How many times have mindless goyim played this game? Or in a more modern context, they'll convert to Christianity, which is Judaism, isn't it? We don't want the wrath of their God to come upon us. So even though we might not like some of the things they're doing today, we still have to be behind them because they're God's people, and he has a special plan. Most Christian dupes, the Zio Pig Christians, actually embrace what the tribe does to the Palestinians. They don't give a damn. But then there's others who might not like it, but they'll still support these bastards because they don't want the wrath of God to come upon them. What's the difference? You might as well fully, you know, swing that other leg over that side of the fence. Complete the job. Complete the picture. Put your goddamn yarmulke on. And, you know, go slaughter a few Palestinians yourself for Jesus. You mindless goddamn frickin' fools. So there you go, guys. That's how it came about. Purim is a day of celebration of their victory over the years through shenanigans like this, hijacking kings, emperors, entire nations, getting them to fight their enemies for them. Germany is the best modern example, guys, what they did to Germany, World War I and World War II. It's the Esther syndrome all over again. The hijacking took place in a different way. They didn't use a Queen Esther. They used their banking system, but still hijacked the goyim, got them to fight their wars, turned nations rabidly against a country whose only crime was to compete with them in their financial empire. That was their crime. And expose their financial shenanigans. You know, that was their crime. Just like Haman, that was his crime. Here's an interesting question to ponder. Is Esther actually the pagan goddess Ishtar? Look at the phonetic similarities. Esther, Ishtar. As mentioned earlier in the Megillah text, Esther is not our heroine's actual name. Why is it used? The name Esther is related to Ashtaroth, which was the equivalent of the Middle Eastern goddess Ishtar. Esther's real name was Hadassah, which of course is the name of a secret society for women in our little tribal community. In Hebrew, it means myrtle tree, but it also parallels with a Persian word meaning star, eastern star, Esther star. Oh my God. The famous late Jewish scientist Isaac Asimov provides us some interesting details about this in his 1969 book, Guide to the Bible. He said, the name Mordecai is not Hebrew and instead seems to be suspiciously like that of chief god of the Babylonians, Marduk, which in Hebrew form is Moradak. As for Esther, the official throne name that came to be carried by Mordecai's cousin, that is even clearly a form of Ishtar, the chief Babylonian goddess. Indeed, the Aramaic version of that goddess's name is Esther. The name Hadassah, by which Esther was originally known within the family, is closely related to a Babylonian word for bride, which is used as a title for Ishtar. And in Babylonian mythology, Marduk and Ishtar are cousins, as are Mordecai and Esther. Well, it may have been one of the purposes, he said, of the writer of the Book of Esther to revise the Babylonian myth into Jewish history and convert a pagan festival into a patriotic Jewish observance. Yeah, don't forget, according to the time frame here, the tribe had just come out of Babylonian frickin' captivity. They used the Persians to overthrow Babylon, right? And rebuild their goddamn temple for them, only later to turn the Greeks on them, and then later the Romans on the Greeks, on and on and on. Goddamn Shiite. Oh, Gentiles, you've been asleep for way too long. Asleep? You've been in a deep, goddamn comatose state. Hadassah, by the way, as I said, is a sleazy woman's psyo organization, a secret society, if you will. Daddy Bush was once asked, you know, what constitutes America for him. You know what he said? He mentioned a bunch of secret societies. To me, America is, most of which people never heard of. He didn't mention the obvious ones like, you know, Freemasonry. But he mentioned Hadassah as one of them. He said that's what constitutes America. Tell me they're not cryptos, ladies and gentlemen. Interestingly, Haman seems to have served as some type of prototype of Christ. Haman is viewed as the enemy of Judaism, as is Christ, at least on the surface. Anyway, Haman was murdered by the Jews, as was Christ. Both were killed in the springtime, and their names were both cursed and were to be blotted out. And as always, I'm cut off midstream. All right, I'll pick up with that on Monday, guys. Have a great weekend. Happy Ishtar Day! Nail yourself to a cross on Sunday, guys, to help pay for your sins and those of anyone else around. And for Yahweh's sins, too. He's the biggest sinner of all. All right, guys. See you Monday. Take care. Everything inside and out and love is strange, surreal in the dark. Think of the tender things that we were working on. Slow change may pull us apart. When a light gets in your heart, baby, don't you forget about me.
Are you constantly thinking naughty, hateful thoughts about the Jews? Do you find yourself actually wishing the gas chambers were real? Do you hate the sight of a yarmulke because it reminds you of the parasitic race that has their greedy little hands in just about everything? Well, then we have got something for you. Ask your doctor about Anti-Semitox. Anti-Semitox is a long-acting injectable lobotomy that assures you will never think those anti-Semitic thoughts ever again. May cause suicide, depersonalization, thoughts of ripping off your skin, your dick may fall off, and you may become infertile. I made the switch to Anti-Semitox. Now I don't even care if I'm a goyim slave. Thanks, Jews!
Shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside. In other places, but the horns, they blowing that sound.